But I'd like to introduce first Susan Martin, who runs the Center for the Study of International Immigration at Georgetown University, especially interested in children. Aria Nair runs the Open Society Institute, which is a multifarious caring and rights agency funded by George Soros. Somebody said Open Society Institute does what the United States government might do in the world if it had the money. Marina Costa is a student at Cambridge Ringe and Latin High School. She is from Brazil, and she has her own wonderful story of her own life to tell. Susan Martin, I wish you would just begin in the context of the children of Heracles. I'd love you to talk about the children of the Diamond Wars, the children of Southeast Asia, the children of INS, the children in the refugee story today.
Yes, but when you talk about refugees today, you're really talking about children. More than 50% of the world's refugees, displaced persons, are children. They're young people. The first time I went into a refugee camp, which is at the Thai-Cambodian border, and I was just struck and by the number of, you had to keep looking down, just the number of little kids that were in that camp. And the kids are, of course, the most vulnerable of the people who were in those camps, but they're also the future of the camps. They're the future of the populations of the refugees that have been forced to flee. And we have refugees around the world today who have fled for quite a lot of different reasons. Most of them have fled because of conflict. Conflict is the principal cause of refugee movements. Children and their families are forced out of their homes because now civilians are actually the target of those conflicts. They're not just a byproduct. It's not just that a bomb falls on them. But increasingly in our wars today, the bombs are aiming at the kids. They're aiming at the families. And so the children become refugees. So that's one category. But we have another category of kids who are much more explicitly being exploited. These are kids who are sold or their parents are just not are unable to support them. They end up in the hands of human traffickers. These are kids who are then sent on to other countries. I was in Thailand a couple of weeks ago. Thailand is one of the main centers of human trafficking. There are kids in brothels. There are kids in sweatshops. There are kids who are involved in every form of child labor and exploitation you can imagine. We don't call them necessarily refugee children, but they're certainly in that same situation. A lucky number of kids try to get to the U.S., and they are the minority. Very, very few refugee kids are able to ever leave the situations they're in. Most are trapped in their own countries. The wars are going on around them. They can't get anywhere. Others are in camps in neighboring countries, but a few try to make it to the United States. Some are lucky. They're admitted. They go to our schools. They become part of our communities. Unfortunately, there's a growing number of kids, particularly those who come by themselves, who are unaccompanied, and they're found by the immigration authorities. They're then detained, and often they're detained now in very, very secure prison-like, actually I shouldn't say prison-like, they're detained in prisons. I shouldn't use the euphemism, because the detention really, and I've seen some of the detention spaces, one half of it will be kids who have committed very serious crimes, and they're incarcerated for their criminal acts. The other half are kids who are asylum seekers. They're escaping horrible situations only to find equally horrible situations here.
Susan, you remind me that earlier this week, Anthony Lewis, one of my gods in journalism, New York Times columnist, spoke of his own grandfather who was sent alone from Russia, probably to avoid the draft, about age 12, probably about a century ago, to this country. And over just two generations, we have one of the great American success stories. What would happen to a 12-year-old child sent alone, as kids are, to this country, getting off at Kennedy Airport today?
Well, he get out of the airplane, he'd go through an inspection. Many of you have traveled abroad. You come back into the U.S., you come face-to-face with an immigration official. If you don't have a visa, you don't have good documents, you'd be apprehended by the immigration officials. And if you say, you know, I can't go home again, it's unsafe for me, it's a terrible place, it's a war going on, then you'll be placed in a proceeding to determine whether you should be allowed to stay. The problem is that a lot of these kids, because they don't have relatives in the U.S., are then kept in detention. And they're sometimes they're fortunate and they're able to find a foster home, a shelter, a community group that's willing to take them and provide guardianship to them. But very often, they're in these jail-like situations that I mentioned before and are just left basically to their own devices. There's no requirement that they have a lawyer. They are eligible to have a lawyer, but if that means they have to pay for it. And if you're not represented in an extremely complicated process, I teach immigration and refugee law. I would never represent myself because I don't know the day-to-day forms, the right thing to say at the right time, the right official to ask to see. So for a 12-year-old, forget it.
What is the chance that he or she is going to end up in what amounts to a prison?
The chances are, I would say probably 50-50, maybe a little better, maybe a little worse, depending on the particular circumstance. And I must admit that the Immigration Service has an extremely tough job, because very often some guy will come in and say, I'm her uncle. I'll take care of her. Her parents wanted me to take custody. I want to take care of her. Well, now you're having to think, is this really an uncle? Or is this a human trafficker who's going to take custody of her to put her into a brothel? Because that's really why he's brought her into the country. And so it's a very, very difficult situation, and it's not easy decisions that have to be made. But unfortunately, right now, it's the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the institution that has caught her, has apprehended her, that makes that decision about what's in her best interest. And that doesn't make sense.
Marina Costa, I would love you to tell your story. And if I may just set a tiny context, Brazil is not one of those countries that we think of as sending refugees out into the world, and yet we know Brazilians are here in huge numbers. They clean our offices and our houses. They cook an astonishing amount of our restaurant food. They work hard. They're happy to be here. Tell us your story, why you left Brazil, how you got here, and how it's going.
Brazil today is not an undeclared war, but we have an undeclared war, which is a civil war. Our country is really poor, and we go through a lot of difficult situations. And my mother was working and we had a normal life, but then her company broke down, and we saw ourselves completely alone. And as time went by, we were evicted from our house. We were on the streets for a while. And I was really scared, and I didn't know where to go. So then my mother decided to come here to try another life, because the way that we were living was impossible. We were living like animals, so she decided to come here, and she came 1 year after I came here too. And we are also really afraid, because when I talk about the civil war, it's because our government just helped the rich people, and the poor people is getting poor every day. And this really, really poor people that goes through prostitution and drugs, they are really angry of the class, the middle class. And 7 months ago, my brother was murdered by children that live on streets because they were angry that my brother had a sneaker and they didn't. So they decided to push pushed my brother from the bridge, and he fell and he died. So all my family were terrified, and they really happy that I'm here, because it would be me and my brother, maybe, who knows. And we went through a lot of hard situations, and I'm not mad at those kids, because I know what they go through, because I went a little bit, I was on the streets for a while, and thanks God I'm here today trying to survive. And I know that a lot of Brazilians are here also because of the violence and because they can't live a dignified life. So they work hard. My mother worked hard too, cleaning bathrooms and cleaning offices at night. At least we could survive what we could do in our countries. And after September 11th, our life became more difficult again, because now we can have some rights that we had before. And I'm really sad about it. I know it's a very hard situation, but I can't go back to my country and live that way and live with the fear to be murdered, as my brother was. And I can't stay here living a dignified life, nor my mother, so I don't know where to go. So I'm not an official refugee, but I'm a kind of refugee because I can't go back to my own country.
What was the vision, what was the plan before 9/11, and what is the plan, the vision of your grown-up life now?
After September 11th, I'm fortunate to study in a very good high school, which is Cambridge Region Light School, with a lot of brilliant teachers that helped me and helped all the immigrants a lot in the bilingual program. And before we could go to college, a lot of immigrants, and maybe try better lives, better than our families that work cleaning offices. And as a lot of ancestors of a lot of people here in the United States, the first generation came and worked hard, and the second could succeed better. And I'm the second generation, but I don't see a future for me. So it's like, before I could see myself going to college and becoming the biologist that I always wanted to be. But today, I don't see any door opening in front of me, and for a lot of immigrants that are here. So I don't know what to do.
Ariana, we should leap right in with a short course on rights here. So many of the Brazilians are not documented, or have some sort of informal or arranged papers. How should we begin to think about the human rights here, the legal rights, the pre-9/11, the post-9/11, the Ashcroft era, the universal, eternal rights question here?
Well, there are rights that people enjoy to be treated as refugees and to obtain asylum. Essentially, if someone can show that they have a well-founded fear of persecution, they are entitled to obtain asylum. When you talk about Ashcroft and when you talk about rights in that context, I think it's worth saying that we've had a number of dark periods in American history when rights have been under attack. And usually it's in circumstances where we fear foreign conspiracies, or when we think that American resolve in a foreign conflict is being undermined by dissent here at home. It goes all the way back to the end of the 18th century and the Alien and Sedition Acts. It happened in the middle of the 19th century with the Know Nothing movement. It happened during World War I when we had about 2,000 federal prosecutions for speech. It happened again after World War I when we were concerned about anarchist bombings. Letter bombs were sent to the homes of a lot of prominent officials, and we had the Palmer raids. We had summary deportations from the United States. It happened during World War II with the Japanese Americans. It happened after World War II with the congressional investigations, the loyalty and security purges. So we've had a number of these occasions. And of course, today there is a real foreign conspiracy. I mean, one isn't making up a foreign conspiracy, and so there is a basis for concern. Unfortunately, it's manifested in a number of violations of civil liberties, and usually in these circumstances, it is immigrants who are the particular targets of the violations. But we have had the USA Patriot Act, preventive detention authorized in that. We have increased wiretapping. We have new Justice Department rules which allow the electronic eavesdropping on conversations between lawyers and their clients. We have people at Guantanamo in legal limbo, and lots of other things of that sort.
Forgive me, I haven't heard an answer to the question of what are the rights here. And I'm very glad we're talking about a Brazilian economic refugee case, because it's different from appeals for asylum. The well-founded fear here is of poverty and of violence comes
ordinarily. Well-founded fear of poverty would not be a basis for refugee status or for asylum. It's essentially political persecution. But there have been cases in which a well-founded fear of persecution has involved something that is not exactly like political persecution. For example, a woman who fears genital mutilation. And there have been cases where that has been decided to be a basis for a well-founded fear of persecution. So I think I can't pronounce on this case. I think one would have to go into it in some depth. And I think Susan was right in suggesting that it's the sort of thing that a lawyer versed in the day-to-day processes of the Immigration and Naturalization Service should look at to see whether there is a legal claim that is appropriate.
But I'd like to learn something about the general situation of economic refugees and perhaps our own hypocrisy in using and enjoying their labor, and the special predicament that they're in under suspicion and INS pressure today as never before. Susan, sort of guide us through this.
Yeah, I think the U.S. is extremely ambivalent about immigration in general, whether it's economic, whether it's political, whether it's people fleeing violence, conflict. I mean, all of us look back on our own roots. We're very proud of our immigrant forebears. We have very rosy glasses about the good immigrants who used to come to the country, and we're nervous about current immigration. And our policies reflect it. We have lots of really good laws on the books that protect people fleeing persecution, or protect people fleeing conflict, protect trafficking victims if they've been exploited. We have laws to protect women who are the victims of violence. We have a lot of good laws. Often the implementation is awful, and the public doesn't have the interest or the sustained will to really make the system work so that we protect the people who need to be protected from this full range of reasons, but secure our borders against the people who really are threats to us. I mean, Arya's absolutely right. There is a serious security threat. But we have to just do a better job at being able to separate the two categories of people. The 99.9999999% of the immigrants who are here, who are contributing their labor, who are benefiting the country, most of whom are legal, not all of whom are here with documented status, and separate them from those who are terrorists, who would commit criminal acts and who would threaten our security. But that's a tiny proportion relative to the much larger number of people who come for a range of reasons that I think we can all understand, even if we wouldn't say every one of them is eligible to come into the United States. And we really have to have a policy that balances these interests in a much, much better way than we do now.
I mean, just in support of that, after 9/11, we had quite a large number of immigrants who were rounded up and subjected to secret detention hearings and then to deportations. So far as anyone knows, there is not one of those cases which resulted in someone being charged as a terrorist. They ended up, back in Pakistan or back wherever. If, in fact, they were terrorists, putting them back in Pakistan doesn't exactly make us safer. They became the victims of our concern. Our concern was legitimate, but I don't think the violations of civil liberties that have taken place primarily at the expense of immigrants are the right way to deal with the genuine security threat.
Rena, can you take us inside the Brazilian extended families here, and especially this spirit in which they're experiencing this whole time? We know some stories about checks sent home, incredible industry, and my impression is very high morale among the Brazilians in this part of the world. What's your picture of it?
I think a lot of Brazilians come here, as I said, because we can't live in our own country a normal life. So when we come here, the jobs that the adults find are really like in restaurants, cleaning offices, and cleaning bathrooms. They're happy. Like all Brazilians that I know like very much be here, because here, although we are cleaning bathrooms and working hard in the restaurants, we can live, we can survive. And when I talk to them, they always have a good attitude. My mother, she always gets home, like she works two jobs, and I just see her on Sundays. And she always with a good attitude, and she's always happy to be here. And we are very happy to be here. And we were really looking forward to see laws that would make us to be legal here, laws of work, that sometimes they appear sometimes the president signs the laws and we can apply if we work in a certain restaurant or if we do a certain kind of job. And a lot of people that I know, they are really, really want to be legal here, pay taxes and live normally. But it's really the situation that not all the time we have those laws that help us to be legal here. So we become illegal. And we really like to be here. This is a very good country for us. And we are happy to be here. And we don't want to be like that the Americans think that we are terrorists. Because all we want is to live a better life and to do the best way for all of us, not like to live normally.
Ariana, would you tell us a bit of your own story as a refugee? 40 years you've been in the rights game, and not a lawyer yet. I mean, that's perhaps the most astonishing part of it all. A lot of it is recounted in Ariana's new book called Taking Liberties. But what's driven all this?
Well, I don't know whether it has driven it all. Perhaps it has. But I was an infant refugee from Nazi Germany. I came to England. Most of my experience in England was very good. British families were extremely generous. The two families that took us in were not exactly wealthy. The breadwinner in one family was a bicycle repairman. The breadwinner in the other family was an insurance agent. I had one bad period of 11 months in which I was in a hostel for refugee children. I hated the place. I stopped speaking while I was there. I've been making up for it ever since. When you asked earlier about a child coming alone at the age of 12, I have an older sister who came to England on her own at the age of 10. And she lived in England for several months before other members of the family arrived. I arrived on August 16, 1939, 2 weeks before the war, so I was one of the last to get out of Germany during that period. But having had the experience of being a refugee as a child and having, for the most part, benefited from what I think was extraordinarily generous treatment, I admire those who do behave generously to refugees, and I have some feeling about the circumstances which cause people to be refugees. In a way, refugees are the personification of the horrendous conflicts that we have all over the world, and all those conflicts seem to be getting worse. At the beginning of the 20th century, about 90% of those who were killed in conflicts were combatants. During the First World War, close to 90% of those who were killed were combatants. And by the end of the 20th century, that had reversed. About 90% of those who were killed were civilians, non-combatants, and it's because of that that so many people become refugees, become internally displaced persons, or feel they have to move when there are nationalist movements in their country. When we talk, for instance, we always leave out large numbers of people. For instance, when the Soviet Union dissolved into 15 countries, they were countries that were determined by ethnic identification. But about 25 million people happened to be in countries other than those of their ethnic kin. And since then, about 10 million of them have felt that they had to flee those countries because the nationalism that comes when you define a country ethnically made it difficult for them to survive. We don't count those people when we count up the internally displaced or the refugees, but there are people in circumstances like that in many parts of the world. As I say, as someone who was treated generously myself, I rather like those who treat such people generously.
I'm interested that you start with England. The matinee audience this afternoon got a talking to by a member of the House of Lords, a lawyer who was trained here and inspired and worked deep in the civil rights movement in this country in the 1960s, went back and sort of applied what he'd learned in Europe for the last 40 years or so. And he felt that Europe has learned the lesson and we haven't, that we've backslid in a terrible way on fundamental rights questions, including the use of the death penalty, but including the black hole of Guantanamo in which recent detainees have disappeared. How are we doing in the short form?
We used to think of ourselves as the fountainhead of rights for the whole world, and everyone looked to us as the embodiment of rights and as the proponent of rights. I think in some ways Europeans exaggerate the violations of rights in the United States, but it is true today that there are more legal protections of rights in Europe than there are in the United States. The courts are not protecting us against the violations of civil liberties that have happened since 9/11. We had a decision the other day from a U.S. appeals court in Virginia dealing with whether an American citizen was entitled to counsel. And the court had this sweeping language about deferring to presidential power on matters that involve war and foreign policy. It went way beyond the actual facts of the case. We've had appellate court decisions on wiretapping, on the secret detention hearings. These cases haven't gone to the Supreme Court yet, but I'm at least very worried about what will happen to them. On the other hand, Europe has the European Court of Human Rights. The European Union has the European Court of Justice, and they're doing very well. For instance, the European Union responded to the Haider affair in Austria by adopting something called its race directive, and all the countries of the European Union and those becoming members have to adopt it by June of this year. They have to comply with it. It provides protection against race discrimination that anybody who has been active in civil rights in the United States could not dream about. It deals with discriminatory effect. It says there have to be dissuasive remedies for race discrimination. It says there has to be an agency in every country to assist victims of race discrimination in bringing complaints. It's inconceivable that you would have had a brief such as the one President Bush approved in the U.S. Supreme Court the other day after that race directive in Europe. So it's gotten to the point where the situation has turned around. The United States was leading the way, and Europe now thinks of us as violating rights because of our huge prison populations, and because of the death penalty and because of Guantanamo. All those things are making Europe think we're a rights violator. And again, I think they exaggerate to some degree, but they also have some point.
Yeah. When it comes to refugee policy, though, I think much of Europe lives in a very glass house, and they probably shouldn't be throwing stones at us. The European, as well as Australian, we're all not doing the rich countries are not doing a very good job in showing generosity towards refugees that Aria was talking about before.
The British, who were so generous to me, had maintained maintained facilities in the Prague airport to weed out Roma, gypsies, to make sure that they wouldn't come to Britain. It wasn't the way they treated me. If they had treated me that way, I wouldn't be alive today.
I'd love to hear from the audience. If you'll just raise your hand or stand, a microphone will come to you at almost the speed of light. Questions, answers, testimonials, as long as they're concise, are entirely welcome. And while you think about it, just another general thought that comes out of the play, really, but challenges us as a nation of immigrants. The Athenians very explicitly raised the question about what is their duty with respect to these children of Heracles as a city-state that defines itself in terms of freedom and refuge for, as it says at the Statue of Liberty, the tempest-tossed of the world. You're giving us better points than Europe, Susan, but against our tradition, how are we doing?
We're doing better and worse. And at the same time that the UK was admitting Aria in, we had a legislation proposed, the Wagner-Rogers Act, to admit 20,000 German orphans, mostly Jews, to come into the country the same 1939. And the U.S. Congress rejected it, saying that the admitting Jews at that point would dilute the bloodstock of the United States. And if you read the congressional testimony, it actually uses those types of words. It was a very eugenics argument, saying that this is a bad type of immigration. So our history has not always been what we'd like to think it has been. We've had some dark periods. And in fact, the reason that our laws today do have special provisions to allow refugees is because we did learn that lesson. We learned the lesson of the St. Louis, the boat of German Jews that tried to land in Florida after having been rejected from other ports, was allowed in nowhere. And this was, again, this was during the 1940s, during the war. And the U.S. refused entry. The passengers had to go back to Europe, and most of them perished in concentration camps. So we have laws today to protect refugees exactly because we have failed in the past. And it's extremely important that we don't fail again, because people die.
Please, in the audience.
Hi. Yeah, I'm one of those political economic refugees from the former Soviet Union in the late 70s. And I guess I find myself sitting here quite resentful of the tone of the discussion, or the discussion is taking. It's reminding me very much of the late 70s, early 80s, blame America first kind of muddle of all sorts of different perspectives, you know, economic refugees and political refugees. And high-flung European perspective again, you know, I still remember the French talking about how we break all the rules in the world. And I'm extremely grateful to this country, you know, which has been housing me for the last 25, 30 years. And I'm also concerned that putting all the problems of people, you know, who want to leave their countries, who want to come here, who want a better life, into one plate makes the problem completely untenable, and this country cannot be expected to address all of those issues, nor can we be expected to address the Europeans' perspective, of which we know a lot about, obviously, if we look a little back in history. So I would like to hear a little more, I guess, no, that's not right, I don't want to direct anything, but I'm resentful about, again, hearing all sorts of criticism of America put together into one stage instead of a discussion of a very real and very painful issue of you know, people displaced by wars in their countries. Thank you.
Now, let me say a few words about that. I mean, one thing we have to keep in mind is that the vast majority of refugees, people who are affected by conflict and repression, are not here, and they never try to get here. A very, very small number, though, do come in and try to gain our protection, and that's the population, really, that we've been talking about today, where the U.S. is face-to-face with that individual who is seeking its protection. Most of our policy is with regard to the refugees and the displaced persons who are in Africa, who are in Afghanistan, who are in Latin America, who are Colombia, who are in Southeast Asia. The U.S. is the most generous provider of both funds and political support for those populations. And, I mean, there's almost no comparison in terms of the level of support that we give. And that's right, and it's fitting with our situation as the world superpower. And I think most of the public is very supportive. When the Kosovars were, you know, finding themselves in some great danger, the American public was there, very much supportive. However, when people are face-to-face here, sometimes those better instincts don't play out as well as they should. And we need to bring home our world leadership in protecting refugees. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. We have the laws, we have the basis for very, very good policies, but too often we're just not implementing them in a way that protects those who really need the protection.
Thank you for the question. Thank you for the answer.
Can I also respond? If I have a complaint about American policy, I suppose the most important complaint is that we allow political considerations to be the major determinant of when we are generous and when we are not generous. I was, let's say, in the 1980s, very much engaged in trying to help a lot of Soviet dissidents come into the United States as refugees. But I was also involved in that period in the wars in Central America. And I recall one particular incident in Guatemala in 1985. There had been no human rights group in Guatemala because it was too dangerous. And then a group had been organized the previous year. It was called the GAM, the Grupo de Apoyo Mutuo, the Group for Mutual Support. It was women whose husbands had disappeared. And then in the end of March, beginning of April of 1985, two of the six leaders of that group were murdered. A third of the six leaders fled the country. And I was dealing with the three women who were remaining, and one of them was absolutely terrified and had two small children. So I went to the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala with that woman. At that moment, Canada had an embassy in Guatemala which was 100% devoted to bringing in refugees. The Australians had an embassy in Mexico City and sent a political officer to Guatemala, and the only role of the political officer was to admit refugees, and they each admitted more than 1,000 refugees a year from Guatemala. When I went to the embassy, the consular officer I dealt with was very sympathetic. He wanted to help, but he said he and no one else at the embassy had ever processed a refugee application, and so they didn't know how to do it. And so the two of us got on the phone to Washington together to figure out how to do it, and I brought that woman. It happened that my wife, who was in the audience, picked me up at the airport, and she was a bit startled to see me carrying the two children of that woman when I brought her into the United States, and she did get asylum status. But the fact that the embassy had never processed a refugee application, didn't know how to do it, at a moment of a war in Guatemala, in which perhaps 200,000 people were killed. That was the number that a clarification commission reached and ultimately called it genocidal. And the Canada and Australia were being extraordinarily generous at that moment, and the United States was admitting no one as a refugee from Guatemala. I resented that. Even though I was delighted to assist the Soviet dissidents, I had no difficulty in getting them asylum status at that moment. But if I hadn't been there in Guatemala City myself and dealing with the U.S. Embassy, that woman would not have made it to the United States.
Thank you.
Hello.
Please.
I have a question. Are the people in the countryside of Brazil suffering as much from this undeclared war as in the city? And also, what town did you live in Brazil?
I lived in Belo Horizonte, which is the capital of Minas Gerais, which is between Rio and São Paulo. The people from the countryside, they are actually really poor because technology is being brought to Brazil. And a lot of them, they don't have opportunities to produce a small farm because the big farms are taking over. So they're really poor, and then they go to the cities as refugees. So when they go to the cities, they don't have any place to go. So they go to places called favelas, which are mountains around the city that they live in, houses of papers, and they don't have any bathroom there. And one of those children killed my brother. That's why I'm not upset with them. And in the cities, we suffer a lot more than in the countryside, because in the countryside, the big farmers and the rich people are taking over. So the small ones go to our city, and the small ones make the violence most of the time. but not their fault. They're just trying to survive. It's the government fault, I believe. Yes, it is the government fault.
Is that what you wanted to know about the undeclared war? That's what I wanted to know, too. Thank you.
Here. Yes, I want to say that while I'm very sympathetic to the economical refugees from Brazil and other Latin American countries, I'm wondering what, given the present political situation in Brazil, where there is a supposedly a more sympathetic president to the poor class, what kind of hopes that Marina feels?
I hope that my country, which is a very beautiful place, will be a better place in the future where not just rich people can take advantage of the beauty, but also poor people. And I really hope that Lula, which is the new president that really likes the poor class, he's going to help us to have an opportunity to be someone, to have jobs, and to don't allow the technology and so many well-trained people that are rich and they have opportunities to go to the universities take over our country and also give opportunities to all equally.
Well said.